The orchestrating cell. Homeostasis, fixity, and balance. Every cell has its own special action, even though it derives its stimulus from other parts. Rudolf Virchow, 1858. Now we will count to 12, and we will all keep still. This one time on the face of the earth, let's not speak any language. Let's stop for 1 second and not move our arms so much. Pablo Neruda, Keeping Still. Most of the cells that we've encountered thus far talk to each other locally. Aside from the cells of the immune system, where a signal from one cell can summon distant cells to the site of infection or inflammation, we haven't heard much about cellular chatter that can reach across the vast expanses of an organism's body. A nerve cell whispers through the synapse to the next nerve cell. Heart cells are so physically conjoined that an electrical impulse within one spreads to the other through junctions between the cells. There are lots of murmurs, but very few shouts. But an organism cannot depend on local communication alone. Imagine an event that affects not just one organ system, but the whole body. Starvation, chronic illness, sleep, stress, each individual organ might mount a particular response to this event. But to return to Virchow's idea of the body as a cellular citizenship, the messages between organs must be orchestrated. Some signal or impulse must move between cells, informing them of the global state that the body is inhabiting. The signals move from one organ to the next, carried by blood. There must be a means for one part of the body to meet a distant part of a body. We call these signals hormones from the Greek hormon, to impel or to set some action into motion. In a sense, they impel the body to act as a whole. Tucked away in a bend in the abdomen, elbowed between the stomach and the swirls of intestines, is a leaf-shaped organ, mysterious, hidden, as one pathologist described it. It has two lobes, called its head and its tail, connected by a body. The Alexandrian anatomist Herophilus, who lived around 300 BC, was likely among the first to identify it as a distinct organ. But he didn't name it. Admittedly, it's hard to attribute a discovery without a name. The name pancreas appears in the medical literature in Aristotle's writing, a so-called pancreas, he wrote, somewhat dismissively, but the word still carried no hint of its function. It was simply labeled pan, all, and creas, flesh, an organ of all flesh. At some point in his anatomical dissections, Galen, 400 years after Herophilus, noted that the pancreas was filled with secretions. But he, too, was uncertain about its function, although that rarely stopped Galen from hazarding a guess. As the vein, the artery, and the nerve join behind the stomach, all these vessels are easily vulnerable at the site of their division. Nature, therefore, has wisely created a glandular body called pancreas, and placed beneath and around it all organs, filling the empty spaces so that none of them may tear without a support. Centuries later, Vesalius drew among the most detailed diagrams of the organ, placing it in relation with the stomach and the liver. He noted that it looked like a big glandular body, and therefore must be designed to secrete something, as glands always do. But then, like Galen, Vesalius returned to the idea that it existed mainly as a supportive structure to keep the stomach from crushing blood vessels against the spine. In short, a cushion filled with some fluid, a glorified pillow. There was, it seemed, only one dissenter to the pancreas as cushion story, and his logic was based on simple anatomical reasoning. Gabriel Fallopius, a biologist in 16th century Padua, couldn't make sense of it all. In animals that walked on four legs, he argued, how could a cushion that sat behind the stomach be of much value? It would be totally useless to animals that walked in prone position, Fallopius wrote. But his perceptive line of reasoning, like the organ that he was thinking about, was soon forgotten. The discovery of the function of pancreatic cells began, inauspiciously, with a quarrel between two anatomists that ended in a murder. The senior of the two, Johann Viersong, was a highly respected German professor of anatomy in Padua. On March 2, 1642, at a hospital attached to the San Franciscan church, Viersung dissected the abdomen of a hanged criminal to remove the pancreas. Several assistants helped with the autopsy, including his student Moritz Hoffmann. As Viersung extracted the pancreas and probed the organ further, he found a previously unnoticed feature. It had a duct that ran through it, later called the main pancreatic duct, heading out toward the intestines. Viersung published a series of medical drawings describing his discovery and sent the plates to the leading anatomists of his time with little comment about the function of such a duct. Although one might have asked, what possible reason might an anatomical cushion have a duct running through it, unless the channel was carrying something? Viersung's claim to his anatomical discovery may have stoked an old rivalry. On the evening of August 16, 1643, just a little more than a year after Viersung had sent off news of the breakthrough identification of the pancreatic duct, he was walking in an alley outside his house in Padua when he was accosted and shot to death by a Belgian assassin. The reasons for this strange and brutal end to his life remain a matter of speculation, but at least one possible motive stands out. Moritz Hoffmann, Viersung's star pupil, was embroiled in a bitter dispute with his mentor. Hoffmann claimed that he had shown Viersung the existence of the pancreatic duct in a bird, and Viersung had used Hoffmann's findings to identify the same duct in humans, giving no credit to his student. The master anatomist, Hoffmann alleged, was actually a masterful plagiarist. One might have thought that Viersung's assassination would send a chill through the field of pancreatic anatomy. I cannot think of another murder incited by a duct, but interest in the function of the pancreas was ignited. If the pancreas wasn't the stomach's cushion, then what was it doing? What was that duct buried inside it carrying? On March 25, 1848, a Saturday morning, Claude Bernard, the physiologist in Paris who coined the concept of homeostasis, performed a crucial experiment. It wasn't an easy time to concentrate on science. Revolutions were swirling around Europe. The French king had just abdicated. Armies were out on the streets, but Bernard was sequestered in his lab. He was more concerned with the restoration of equilibria in the body, with how cells could maintain a steady state. Unlike Virchow, he wasn't particularly interested in keeping the state steady. He extracted pancreatic juice out of a dog and added a lump of candle fat to it. In about 8 hours, he found the juice had emulsified the fat, broken it down into small particles, such that a layer of milky droplets floated above it. Building on prior work done by other physiologists, Bernard found that pancreatic juices secreted by pancreatic cells would also break down starches and proteins, in essence converting complex food molecules into simpler, digestible units. In 1856, Bernard published Memoirs sur le Pancréas, in which he detailed his idea that the pancreas released these juices to enable digestion. The duct that Viersung had discovered then was the central channel for these juices. It relayed them into the digestive system, where they broke down complex food molecules into simple ones. He had, at last, found the function of the gland. But the world must also be measured by eye. By the time Bernard was done with his physiological studies on the pancreas, cell theory was in its full glory, and microscopists had already trained their lenses on the microanatomy of the pancreatic gland. And in the winter of 1869, when the physiologist Paul Langerhans looked at thinly cut slices of pancreatic tissue through a microscope, he found that the organ hid yet another surprise. As expected, he found the ducts that Viersung had described, surrounded by large, distended, berry-shaped cells that would later be identified as the ones producing the digestive juices. Acinar cells, as they would eventually be called. Acinus is Latin for berry. But as Langerhans's eyes turned his lens to look beyond the acinar cells, he found a second cellular structure. Nestled within the pancreas and distinct from the acinar cells, he discovered little islands of cells that stained bright blue with a cellular dye. These cells looked entirely different from those that produced the digestive juices. They were often widely separated from each other, seeming to float like archipelagos of islands in the sea of pancreatic tissue. In time, the clusters would be called islets of Langerhans. The field was again rife with questions and speculations about the function of these islands of cells. The pancreas, it seemed, was a gland that kept on giving. See the image in the attached PDF. In July 1920, Frederick Banting was a surgeon working in a suburb of Toronto. His practice was small and floundering, and he often sat alone in his clinic without any cases. That July, he earned $4. In September, $48. Barely enough for him to afford basic comforts, let alone continue his clinic. He drove a beat-up fifth-hand car, which ran for about 250 miles and then fell into pieces. As debt and doubt mounted that fall, Banting took a job as a medical demonstrator, an assistant to the main lecturer at the University of Toronto. Late one evening, in October 1920, he read an article in the journal Surgery, Gynecology, and Obstetrics, describing the development of diabetes in patients who had developed various diseases of the pancreas, including stones that had clogged up the ducts carrying digestive juices. The author noted how some of these diseases, especially the ones that caused plugged ducts, led to the degeneration of the acinar cells, the ones that produce the digestive enzymes. But the odd thing was that while the acinar cells typically shriveled and degenerated early when the ducts got clogged, the islet cells managed to survive much longer. Diabetes, the author noted almost parenthetically, did not typically develop until the islet cells of Langerhans had finally degenerated. Banting was intrigued. The function of the islands of cells was unknown. Perhaps they had some relationship with diabetes, a disease of sugar metabolism when the body cannot sense or adequately signal the presence of sugar, causing sugar to build up in blood and spill out in urine. Diabetes was a mystifying illness. Banting tossed and turned through a sleepless night, pondering the idea. Perhaps the pancreas, two-lobed, was in fact two-minded. Generations of physiologists, Bernard most prominently among them, had concentrated exclusively on its external function, the secretion of digestive juices. But what if the islet cells secreted a second chemical, an internal substance that sensed and regulated glucose? The dysfunction of these cells would make the body unable to sense glucose and send the levels of the sugar spiking sky high in the blood, the fundamental hallmark of diabetes. I thought about the lecture and about the article, and I thought about my miseries and how I would like to get out of debt and away from my worry, Banting wrote. He jotted down the vague outlines of an experiment. If he could separate the external and internal functions, the secretions of the acinar cells from the secretion of the islets, he might find the substance responsible for sugar control, the key to understanding diabetes. Diabetes, he wrote that evening. Ligate the pancreatic ducts of dogs. Keep dogs alive till acini degenerate, leaving islets. Try to isolate the internal secretion of these to relieve glycosuria, sugar in the urine, a sign of diabetes. Karl Popper, the eminent historian of science, once recounted the story of a man in the Stone Age, asked to imagine the invention of the wheel in some distant future. Describe what this invention will look like, his friend asks. The man struggles to find words. It'll be round and solid like a disc, he says. It will have spokes and a hub. Oh, and an axle to connect it to the other wheel, also a disc. And then the man pauses to reconsider what he's done. In anticipating the invention of the wheel, he has already invented it. In later years, Banting would describe his notes from that October evening much like the invention of the wheel. As far as he was concerned, he had already discovered the hormone that controls sugar, later to be named insulin. But where might he perform the experiment to prove it? Goaded into confidence by some combination of anxiety and intrigue, he soon plucked up the courage to approach one of the most senior professors in Toronto, a serious, scholarly Scotsman named John MacLeod, to try an experiment on dogs. The initial meeting on November 8, 1920, was a disaster. They met in MacLeod's office, where a desk was covered in sheaves of paper, and the professor distractedly flipped through some of them as they talked. MacLeod had worked on sugar metabolism for decades and was a towering figure in the field, compassionate but exacting. He wasn't impressed. Perhaps he had expected Banting to have in-depth knowledge about diabetes and the metabolic response to sugar. Instead, he found an insecure young surgeon with little research experience talking about an organ he seemingly knew little about and a stumbling, incoherent plan to explore it. Nonetheless, McLeod agreed to let Banting try his experiment with some dogs in his lab. Banting pestered him relentlessly. The experiment had to work. In the end, McLeod assigned one of two students to help Banting. The students tossed a coin to see who would work with Banting first. A gifted young researcher, Charles Best, won the toss. Banting and Best began their main experiments in the broiling heat of the summer of 1921, operating on dogs in a dusty, unused, tar-roofed lab on the top floor of the medical building. On May 17th, McLeod showed Best and Banting how to perform a pancreatectomy on dogs, a two-step process that was far trickier than had been described in journal articles. The lab was barely equipped, and the heat was oppressive. Banting, dripping with perspiration, cut off the sleeves of his lab coat. "We found it next to impossible to keep the wound clean in very hot weather," he complained. The experiment that Banting had devised was simple in principle, but devilishly complex in practice. In some dogs, they would surgically stitch the ducts of the pancreas closed until the acinar cells had atrophied and died, but the islet cells remained, following the protocol of the surgical paper that Banting had read. In a second set of dogs, they would remove the whole pancreas. No acini, no islets, and so no islet substance. By transferring the secretions between the two groups, one with islets and the ones without, they would identify the function of the islet cells and the material substance secreted by them. The first attempts were failures. Best killed the first dog with an overdose of anesthetic. The second died from bleeding, and a third from an infection. It took several attempts before Banting and Best could get a dog to survive long enough to perform the very first stage of the experiment. Late that summer, with the temperature still rising, dog 410, a white terrier, had its whole pancreas removed. As expected, it began to experience mild diabetes, with blood sugar levels about twice the normal level. It was far from the most extreme case, but Banting and Best decided it was good enough. The next step was crucial. They ground up the pancreas from a dog that had intact islet cells left and injected the extracted juice into the terrier. If the islet substance existed, it should reverse the diabetes. An hour later, the terrier's sugar normalized. They injected a second dose, and again, the sugar returned to normal. Banting and Best repeated the experiment over and over. Remove the pancreatic extract from a dog, leaving the islets intact. Inject the extract into a diabetic dog and measure the blood sugar level. After multiple attempts, they began to gain confidence that something secreted by the islet cells was causing the blood sugar to go down. They concocted a name for a substance they had only seen in abstract. Ileton, they called it. Ileton was a difficult substance to work with. Temperamental, unstable, unpredictable. As its name suggested, insular. But McLeod began to believe that Banting and Best had actually found something important, even if the signal was weak. He soon assigned another scientist to the project, James Collop, a young Canadian biochemist who had already proved himself to be a savant of biochemical extractions. Collop's job was to purify the elusive substance Ileton out of pancreatic extracts that Banting and Best had made. The first attempts were crude, and their effects disappointing. Collop worked with liter upon liter of soupy, ground-up pancreatic sludge, trying to follow the hint of the sugar-reducing activity that Banting and Best had seen in dogs. Eventually, he had a first sample, dilute and impure, but a preparation extracted from the pancreas nonetheless. The crucial test of the extract was to determine if it might reverse diabetes in a human patient. It was a tense clinical experiment. The subject was Leonard Thompson, a 14-year-old boy in the throes of a severe diabetes crisis. Sugar poured out of his urine. His body, cachectic and starving, was a heap of skin and bones. He drifted in and out of a coma. In January 1922, Banting injected him with the crude extract, but the result was disappointing. The boy had a mild, nearly undetectable response that soon flickered away. Banting and Best felt defeated. Their first human experiment had ended in failure. But Kollop forged ahead with purer and purer extractions. If the substance existed anywhere in the pancreas, he would find a way, some method, to purify it. He sourced new solvents, found novel methods of distillation, varied temperatures, and changed concentrations of alcohol to solubilize the material until he'd found a highly purified extract. On January 23, 1922, the team returned to Thompson. The boy, still desperately ill, was injected again with Kollop's highly purified extract. The effect was immediate. The sugar in the blood dropped dramatically. It disappeared from the urine. The sweet, fruity smell of ketones in his breath, an ominous warning of a body in severe metabolic crisis, dissipated. The boy, semi-comatose, woke up. Banting now wanted more of the extract to treat more patients, but Kollop, a latecomer, refused to give the team the protocol for purification. After all, hadn't he solved the puzzle? Psychologically and physically strained to the point of breaking, Banting, the man who had hunted this substance, Ahab-like, for 4 years, walked into Kollop's lab and grabbed his overcoat. He threw Kollop onto a chair and clasped his hands around Kollop's neck, threatening to throttle him. Had Best not intervened at the right moment and pulled the two men apart, the pancreas would have been responsible for not one, but two murders. In the end, a fragile truce was reached between Kollop, Best, McLeod, and Banting. They licensed the purified substance to the university and set up a lab to produce more of it to treat patients. Its name was changed from Eilton to insulin. A larger clinical trial proved an equal and dramatic success. The sugar levels in patients injected with insulin dropped precipitously. Semi-comatose children with ketoacidosis woke up. Cachectic wasted bodies gained weight. Soon, it was evident that insulin was the master regulator of sugar metabolism, the hormone responsible for sensing sugar and sending a signal to the cells throughout the body. In 1923, just 2 years after Banting and Best had performed their first experiment, Banting and McLeod were awarded the Nobel Prize for the discovery of insulin. Banting was so perturbed at the choice of McLeod and the exclusion of Best that he declared that he would split his prize privately with Best. McLeod countered that he would split his half with Kollop. History has, perhaps appropriately, pushed McLeod, who had alternated between skeptical and supportive through the whole project, to the background. The discovery of insulin is now widely attributed to Banting and Best. Insulin, we now know, is synthesized by a particular subset of islet cells in the pancreas, beta cells, and its secretion is stimulated by the presence of glucose in the blood. It then travels all over the body. Virtually every tissue responds to insulin. The presence of sugar means that the extraction of energy and everything that flows from energy, the synthesis of proteins and fats, the storage of chemicals for future use, the firing of neurons, the growth of cells, can proceed. It is, perhaps, among the most important of the long-range messages that acts as a central coordinator and orchestrates metabolism all through the body. Type 1 diabetes, which affects several million patients around the globe, is a disease in which immune cells attack the beta islet cells of the pancreas. Without insulin, the body cannot sense the presence of sugar, even if there is enough of the chemical in the blood. The cells in the body, imagining that the body has no sugar, begin to scramble around for other forms of fuel. The sugar, meanwhile, all readied up but with nowhere to go, spikes threateningly in the blood and spills into the urine. Sugar, sugar everywhere, but not a molecule in cells to satiate them. It is one of the defining metabolic crises of the human body, cellular starvation in the presence of plenty. For decades, since the discovery of insulin, the lives of millions of type 1 diabetics have been transformed. When I trained in medicine in the 1990s, patients used to check their blood sugar levels using drops of blood tested on monitors and inject themselves with the right dose of the drug based on a chart. Now, there are implantable monitors that check your blood glucose continuously, continuous glucose monitors, or CGMs, and pumping machines that automatically dispense the correct dose of insulin. It is a closed-loop system. But the dream of diabetic researchers is to make humans with bio-artificial pancreases. If beta cells could somehow be cultured inside an implantable sac and inserted into a human being, then the cells might function autonomously, sensing glucose, secreting insulin, perhaps even dividing to form more beta cells. Such a device would require a supply of blood to bring nutrients and oxygen in, and an exit to send the insulin out. And most importantly, it would have to be protected from the immune attack, for example, the autoimmune killing of the islet cells by the person's immune system that had started the diabetes in the first place. In 2014, a team led by Doug Melton at Harvard published a method to take human stem-like cells and coax them, step by step, to form insulin-producing beta cells. Melton began his academic career as a developmental and stem cell biologist, studying the signals that an embryo uses to make organs and how stem cells respond to these signals. Then, both of Melton's children developed type 1 diabetes. When Melton's son Sam was 6 months old, he began shaking and vomiting, ultimately becoming so sick that he was rushed to the hospital. His urine was dense with sugar. Melton's daughter, Emma, born a few years earlier, also eventually developed the illness. For a while, as Melton told a journalist, Melton's wife was their children's pancreas, pricking their fingers 4 times a day, checking glucose levels, and injecting them with the right dose of insulin. But over the years, that personal saga has turned Melton into a diabetes researcher on a compulsive quest to make human beta cells and implant them into the body, a bio-artificial pancreas. Melton's strategy was to recapitulate human development. Every human begins his or her life as a single pluripotent cell, that is, a cell capable of giving rise to all tissues in the body, and eventually buds out a pancreas fully capable of sensing sugar and developing insulin-producing islet cells. If it could be done in utero, Melton believed it could be done in a petri dish with the right factors and steps. Over the next 2 decades, many scientists in Melton's lab worked to coax human pluripotent stem cells to form islet cells, but they would inevitably get stuck in the penultimate stage before becoming mature. One evening in 2014, a postdoctoral researcher named Felicia Paliuka stayed up late in Melton's lab performing experiments. Her husband had already called her, asking her to come home for dinner, but Paliuka had one last experiment to finish. She added a dye to the stem cells that she had coaxed along the islet cell pathway, hoping it would turn blue, a sign that they were making insulin. At first, she saw a faint blue tinge, but then it grew darker and darker. She looked again, and then again to confirm that her eyes weren't misleading her. The cells had made insulin. Melton, Paliuka, and their team reported their success that year. The cells that they had generated, Melton's team wrote, express markers found in mature beta cells, flux calcium in response to glucose, a sign that they've detected the sugar, package insulin into secretory granules, and secrete quantities of insulin comparable to adult beta cells in response to multiple sequential glucose challenges in vitro. They're as close as researchers have gotten to making human beta cells that survive and function and can be grown into millions of cells. The insulin-secreting cells made out of stem cells have now found their way to clinical trials. One strategy is to take these millions of islet cells and infuse them directly into a patient's body while giving the patient immunosuppressants to prevent the rejection of the cells. One of the first patients to receive the infusion, a 57-year-old type 1 diabetic from Ohio named Brian Shelton, seems to have achieved sugar control, a crucial first step in measuring the effectiveness of the whole strategy. More patients are being rapidly enrolled in the trial. A potential next step is to encapsulate these cells into a device that is immune-protected, stable in the body, and that can act as entry and exit slots for nutrients. A team involving Jeff Karp, also at Harvard, is devising tiny implantable machines that might achieve these goals. Sometime in the future, we might encounter a new kind of diabetic patient with no injections, batteries, or beeping monitors. Instead, the batteries and monitors will be worn, like those getting deep brain stimulation for Parkinson's disease or depression. After so many winding errors and misconceptions, one murder, one throttling, one Nobel Prize split into four, and that unforgettable moment of a blue stain spreading on a cluster of cells, we may have solved the conundrum of the two-minded organ and made it into a bio-artificial self. Once that neo-organ integrates into our bodies, the pancreas, the central coordinator of metabolism, the maker of the hormone to which all tissues respond, would live up to its Greek name. It would become part of us, a new form of all flesh. You go out for dinner one evening, perhaps in Venice, Italy, a resplendent restaurant near the Giardini, the public gardens of the city near the banks of the Bacino di San Marco. You begin with baccalà mantecato, the whipped salt cod concoction that the Venetians stole from the Portuguese and appropriated into a national culinary monument. There's a mound of toasted bread and a gigantic bowl of rigatoni to follow, and enough chablis to fill a small canal. Perhaps you don't realize as you walk back that a cellular cascade has been activated. Leave aside digestion for a moment. It is the metabolic cascade and the restoration of chemical balance that is the small miracle of cell biology that unfolds in your body as you walk back to your hotel. The carbohydrates from the bread and rigatoni are digested into sugars, ultimately into glucose. The glucose is picked up from the intestines, absorbed into blood, and moved into circulation. When the blood reaches the pancreas, it senses the spike in glucose and sends out insulin. The insulin, in turn, moves the sugar from the blood into all the cells of your body where it can be stored, if needed, or used for energy as needed. The brain is the ultimate recipient of these signals. If the sugar drops too low, it reacts by sending out converse signals. Yet other hormones, secreted by different cells, send signals to release stored sugars into the blood. The stores come from liver cells, which respond, at least transiently, by releasing their stockpiles of stored glucose to restore equilibrium. But what about all the salt? Your body was just assaulted by sodium chloride. If there was no restoration, day upon day, your blood would slowly become ocean water with the salinity of the canal that you just sat next to. And so, perhaps unaware of it, you feel a pang of thirst. You drink one, two, perhaps three glasses of water, and now a second metabolic sensor kicks in. To understand how the salt gets dispensed, we need to understand the cell biology of another orchestrating organ, the kidney. Deep within the kidney lies a multicellular anatomical structure called the nephron. Each nephron, first identified by cellular anatomists in the late 1600s, can be imagined as a mini-kidney. The nephron is the site where the blood and kidney cells meet, and the first drops of urine are generated. The circulation of blood carries the excess salt, dissolved in plasma, to the kidneys. The blood vessels split and split further to form finer and finer walled arteries. Finally, the thinnest arteries whirl around themselves to form a thin-walled nest of cells, so delicate and porous that the liquid, non-cellular part of blood, plasma, can leak out of the vessels into the nephron, that is, into the mini-kidney. The liquid then moves through a membrane that surrounds the vessels and finally through a wall of specialized kidney cells that form a fenestrated barrier. Each one of these transitions, out of the blood vessel, in through a membrane, and through the walls of the kidney cell, serves as a filter. Large proteins in cells are selectively left behind, only allowing small molecules, such as salts, sugar, and metabolic waste products, to pass through. The liquid, urine, then moves into a collecting bowl and then into a system of cell-lined tubes called the renal tubules. The tubules connect to pipes that drain into larger collecting tubes, like tributaries joining to form a river, until they converge on the large duct, the ureter, that brings urine into the bladder. Back, then, to the sodium that you consumed. The excess sodium causes a hormonal system regulated by the kidney and the adrenal gland, which sits just above the kidney, to decrease its signal. The cells in the tubule respond to these changes by excreting the excess sodium into urine, thereby discarding the salt and returning the sodium level to normal. The salt is also detected by specialized cells in the brain that monitor the overall concentration of salts in the blood, a property called osmolality. These cells, sensing a high osmolality, send out another hormone to cause the cells in the kidney to retain more water. As more water is absorbed into the body, the sodium level in the blood is diluted, and the concentration is reset, albeit at the cost of retaining more water overall. You might find your feet swollen the next morning, but you might well argue that the bacala was worth the shoes that don't fit. What then of the non-waste products? Why don't we lose essential nutrient molecules or sugars every time we make urine? The sugar and other essential products are reabsorbed into the body by the cells in the collecting duct through special channels. The answer returns us to one of the strange strategies often used by cells. We generate excess and then pare it back to restore normalcy. And the alcohol, the last cell type in this trio of orchestrating cells, or quarto if you count the brain, are the cells of the liver, hepatocytes. The liver cell is functionally specialized for both storage and waste disposal, secretion, protein synthesis, among dozens of many other functions. But waste disposal is so essential for the body, and the liver so deeply specialized for it, that it's worth its own focus. We think of metabolism as a mechanism to generate energy. But flip it around, and it's also a mechanism to generate waste. The kidney dispenses some of this, as mentioned before, through urine. But the kidney is not a detoxifying plant. Its master plan for waste is to merely wash it away down a sewer. Liver cells, in contrast, have evolved dozens of mechanisms to detoxify and dispense waste. In one system, it generates a sacrificial molecule that attaches itself to a potentially toxic one and renders it inactive. Both the sacrificial molecule and the toxin are then broken down further until the poison is detoxified. For other waste products, it destroys the chemical using specialized reactions. Alcohol, for instance, is detoxified in a series of reactions until it's broken down into a harmless chemical. There are even specialized cells within the liver that eat dead or dying cells. Red cells, for instance. Reusable products from the dead cells are recycled. Others are dispensed into the intestines or excreted by the kidney. Liver cells, in short, are also part of the orchestra of regulation and constancy. Except, unlike pancreatic islet cells, they perform their regulation locally. The pancreatic cell maintains metabolic constancy, the kidneys, salt constancy. The liver maintains chemical constancy. In the early spring of 2020, the labs were closed because of COVID metastasizing through New York and the world. I was seeing limited numbers of patients in the hospital, partly because, yet unvaccinated, the vaccines were yet to be approved, I feared transmitting an infection to my chemotherapy-receiving patients whose immune systems could not battle a lethal virus. I still tended to the sickest, the most vulnerable. The oncology wing of the hospital went on heroically, kept alive by nurses. When not in the hospital or the lab, I spent my weekends in a house on a bluff that overlooked Long Island Sound. By the early light of morning, with the geometric crosshatches of sunbeams streaming across the lawn like rays of light coming out of prism, I would watch two ospreys that had come to nest there. They would fly up above the ocean and then miraculously seem to sit still in midair, even while capricious gusts of wind might arrive from any direction. The writer Carl Zimmer described the same phenomenon in bats. Their miraculous fixity in midair, he wrote, was another form of homeostasis at work. The liver, pancreas, brain, and kidney are four of the principal organs of homeostasis. Note that I said principal. Every cell in every organ in the body has some form of homeostasis. Some are unique, while some are common to all cells, as we discussed in Part 1. The pancreatic beta cells control metabolic homeostasis through the hormone insulin. The kidney's nephrons control salt and water, maintaining a constant level of salinity in the blood. The liver, among many of its functions, prevents us from being soused in toxic products, including ethanol. The brain coordinates this activity by sensing levels, sending out hormones, and acting as a master orchestrator of balance restoration. Stillness. Counting to 12. Now we will count to 12 and we will all keep still. Perhaps the most underrated of our qualities. In the end, of course, we will all be blown out of position by some fierce gust of pathological aberration in one of these systems of cells, but the four guardians of homeostasis, working together, like systems of wing and tail feathers, adjusting ever so slightly as the winds change direction, keep the organism in position. When those systems succeed, there is fixity. There is life. When they fail to operate, the delicate balance is thrown off. The osprey can no longer stay still. Part 6. Rebirth. Old age is a massacre, Philip Roth wrote, but in truth, it is a maceration. The steady grind of injury upon injury, the unstoppable decline of function into dysfunction, and the inexorable loss of resilience. Humans counter this decline by two overlapping processes, repair and rejuvenation. By repair, I am referring to the cellular cascade that begins upon injury. It is typically marked by inflammation, followed by the growth of cells to seal the damage. Rejuvenation, on the other hand, refers to the constant replenishment of cells, typically from a reservoir of stem or progenitor cells, in response to the natural death and decay of cells. Both diminish, either in the number of stem cells or in their function, drastically with age. The rate of repair decelerates. The reservoir of rejuvenation decays. One of the remaining mysteries of cell biology is why, in adulthood, some organs can repair and some rejuvenate, while others lose both capacities. Blood-forming stem cells can completely regenerate a blood system, but the death of a neuron almost never regenerates a neuron in its place. Other organs mix and match the two processes. Bone, perhaps, is among the most complex. It uses repair and rejuvenation to combat decay. Cells that can repair bone remain throughout adulthood, albeit much diminished in function with age. But the cells that form cartilage and joints decay dramatically with age. My mother broke her ankle and the crack healed, if slowly, but the joints in her knees are irreversibly swollen, never to return to the suppleness of her childhood when she clambered so easily up guava trees. Finally, we turn to a cell type that defies decay. The cancer cell, or rather, various cancer cells. Is that because some cancers behave like organs that possess reservoirs of rejuvenation? Cancer stem cells? Or is it just that the cells keep giving rise to cells, as they do when an organ repairs itself after injury? Is cancer a disease of repair or rejuvenation, or both? Yet another persistent mystery of cancer is why some malignant cells grow in certain organs while refusing to grow in others. Is there something about the surrounding milieu of cells that support or reject cancers? The nutrients they supply? Clearly, there is an understanding of the cellular ecology of cancer that we are missing. And so, we end our story of cells by borrowing concepts from ecology. We've learned about cells, systems of cells, organs, and tissues, but there is yet another layer of organization left to learn, the ecosystems of cells. It is the music that drives the complexity of cellular physiology, and conversely, the playlist of malignant pathology that remains one of the unsolved puzzles of cell biology.